Okay, go ahead and have a seat. Good morning to Westosha Central High School. It's nice to have you here today. Second big group from Kenosha. Wonderful. It's really great to see you. If you could stand up, we'd like to acknowledge your presence. Good. Good. Afterwards, I've just been given a heads up that Justice Hagedorn is the one that will be meeting with you today instead of Justice Karofsky. He also will not discuss the cases with you, but what answer any questions that you might have. And I know that he's quite smart, so I hope you come up with some that really baffle him and make him go back and do work on that a little bit so he can be stunned by your brilliance. All right? Nice to have you here today. Go ahead and have a seat. Calling our second case of the morning, City of Waukesha versus City of Waukesha Board of Review, 19 AP 1479. Appearances, please. Good morning. All right, the lineup is 25 minutes, followed by 30 and 5 in rebuttal. Okay, please proceed.
Madam Chief Justice, Justices, good morning. May it please the Court. This case arises from a City of Waukesha Board of Review hearing took place in May 2018. The city assessor had increased the assessment of a non-exempt portion of a church's property from $51,900 to $642,200. The impetus for that change, for the reassessment, was the assessor becoming aware that the property was listed for sale at $1.45 million, which suggested strongly to them that their assessment might have been out of date and not accurate. The taxpayer in this case, the church, filed an objection with the Board of Review, of course. The church did not have an appraisal. They did not present an expert. They presented no expert testimony. They instead presented an individual church member who admitted that he had no experience or training in valuing property.
Question, have you ever done this before? Have you ever, let's be more specific.
He may be brilliant. I'll have to see it.
Not starting yet. Yeah, there we go. Have you ever sued the Board of Review before over an individual had the petition for cert over a valuation?
Right. In my time as the city attorney in Waukesha, we have not asked for certiorari review of the Board of Review.
Are you familiar with any other situations where this has ever happened before?
Only anecdotally. I am not aware of any published decisions in which that has happened. I'm only aware from hearing from other city attorneys that they have done it. I believe that the absence of published opinions on this really only shows that there has not been a case that has gone to an appellate court and has resulted in a published decision. It does not mean that it has never been done before. It may very well be that this is a case of first impression. That's certainly a possibility, and if it is, then so be it. Impression.
So one, inference from the statutory structure, and I think this underlays a lot of the Court of Appeals opinion, but conceptually, help me out with this here. It seems that the Board of Review is the mechanism by which the City of Waukesha makes its property tax determinations. It strikes me as really odd to have the city, in one sense, if that inference is correct, sue itself, or sue an agent of itself, the mechanism by which it, again, makes these decisions. Am I thinking about that incorrectly, or where am I wrong on that?
The The Board of Review is not the city agency that creates assessments. The Board of Review is a separate entity, which is a quasi-judicial body before which the city is a party. It is not a part of the city. It's not an agency of the city. It doesn't act on behalf of the city. It's an entity that's created by statute, is appointed by the city to act as a place for appeals to go by taxpayers if they feel that the assessor has assessed the property incorrectly.
Just one follow-up question along a different line, and that is, obviously the statutes say what the statutes say, and we're in a situation where maybe they're a little less than perfectly clear here, though maybe there's a better reading than another. Structurally speaking, does it make sense for the city of Waukesha to, in a sense, put taxpayers to the responsibility of defending the assessments that have been made? I mean, it strikes me as a difficult thing to put on a taxpayer. You got a whole structure that seems to be, the design of it is to allow taxpayers to challenge the government, right? And then you here have the government that essentially what makes a taxpayer need to hire a tax attorney every time they challenge their tax assessment. That's a really odd and potentially dramatic thing. And again, the fact that this hasn't been done before, I agree it doesn't settle the matter, but it sure is an odd structure to have the city suing suing the taxpayer.
Well, I have to respectfully disagree. The Board of Review is a body which is charged with ensuring that the assessments that are determined by the assessor are correct. And the Board of Review has the ability both to increase and decrease assessments. Its decisions can cut both ways. The taxpayer that goes before the Board of Review will frequently be represented by a tax representative or an attorney. And that's a choice they make because there are strict legal requirements placed upon a taxpayer that's coming before the Board of Review. There's a burden of proof there that has to be met, and frequently they do come with an attorney. But the Board of Review can act either in favor of the taxpayer or in favor of the city, either way. The charge on the Board of Review is to make sure that the assessments are accurate, are fair. The city, the taxation district, is made a party in interest to those proceedings, specifically because its interest is to ensure, I think the language is to sustain or to make sure that the assessments are equitable. That is an indication that the Board of Review is not acting as an agency of the city. As I said, it's a quasi-judicial body which has the power to rule against the city. It has the power to subpoena witnesses and information from the city. The city goes before the Board of Review as a party, just as the taxpayer does. So I think it is not an accurate statement to say that the city is suing itself.
Would it be fair to say that the Board of Review acts as an internal check on the exercise of power by the municipality?
I do not think it's accurate to say that it's an internal check. It is certainly a check on the assessor's power. It's specifically created to make sure that if the assessor makes an incorrect assessment, there is a place to go, that the taxpayer has a place to go and to prove that the assessor was incorrect. However, again, I think it's an incorrect characterization to frame the Board of Review as internal in any way or as an agency somehow of the city.
Well, you use that term because it is, in fact, called the City of Waukesha Board of Review. So in that sense, it is a body that exists internal to the city of Waukesha. I understand and I agree with you that it is a quasi-judicial body exercising independence. In other words, it doesn't exist. Its purpose is not and its powers are not to favor the city of Waukesha, but it is an entity that exists as part of the city of Waukesha, right?
Certainly. The statutes require that the city appoints the Board of Review and creates the Board of Review. Many cities will do that each year. Waukesha is slightly different in that its Board of Review is, the members have terms of 3 years. But either way, the Board of Review is by statute required to be appointed by the city. And of course, it is the city of Waukesha Board of Review because, well, to distinguish it from the boards of review of all of the other cities, each taxation district has to have a Board of Review. And that's simply the mechanism that was chosen by the legislature for the creation of the Board of Review. It's up to the individual taxation districts to create their own Board of Review.
Attorney Running, I'm having the most difficulty with the actual provision that provides for how these actions are appealed, because it says that appeal from the determination of the Board of Review shall be by an action for certiorari commenced within 90 days after the taxpayer receives the notice. And that is a very interesting way if the city is able to bring an appeal for that to be the trigger. The city might know when the decision is reached, but the city is not going to know when the taxpayer receives the notice. So help me out with why this gives the city the ability to also bring certiorari.
Sure. Again, I have to respectfully disagree. The city certainly will know when the taxpayer receives notice. Subsection 12 of Section 7047 requires that the notice be provided to the taxpayer, but it also requires that the clerk create an affidavit saying when that delivery took place.
Wait, but what is, so the notice is provided how? I don't have sub 12 in front of me.
It's served upon the taxpayer.
It's served. But
yes.
But you don't know when it's served, right? How would the city know when it's served on the taxpayer?
By looking at the affidavit that the clerk prepares. The requirement that the notice be served upon the taxpayer is to ensure that the taxpayer is aware of the decision of the Board of Review. The taxpayer is the only party to the proceeding that does not have some other procedural means of being notified
right, but,
of the board's decision.
When we're talking about the notice, it can be by mail. So, I mean, I'm just not understanding. It just doesn't make sense to me why that would be a provision that would be placed in there if there were the ability for more than just the taxpayer to bring search. Why would that be there? And not that we're supposed to look at why, but it's just I'm trying to make sense of it from the argument that you're making.
Sure. As I say, if subsection 12 did not exist, there would be no procedural requirement that the taxpayer be given notice of the Board of Review's decision. It exists to ensure that the taxpayer does receive notice of the decision. Every other party has already a pre-existing built-in means of becoming aware of the Board of Review's decision.
How is that built-in means? I have some concerns like Justice Stallett has.
Sure.
I mean, if the city was able to appeal its own Board of Review's decision, why doesn't the city also get notice of the Board of Review's decision? And if you're going to tell me they have notice because the clerk makes the record, well, that kind of cuts against your argument that the city is separate from the Board of Review. So can you help me with that?
Sure. Look at the structure of how this procedure takes place. When the Board of Review makes its decision, it's either going to lower or increase or keep the assessment the same. No matter what, that decision has to somehow be reflected in the assessment roll.
Mm-hmm.
If the Board of Review's decision were not communicated somehow to the city, then there would not be an adjustment made to the assessment rolls, and there would be no point.
That may be the case, but there's a 90-day window in subsection 13 that says that 90 days after the taxpayer receives notice, then the right to certiorari review is cut off if it's not been taken. So what if the city doesn't go look at the clerk's records? And I don't know who the city is in this way we're talking about it here. So is there a person designated by the city as the city attorney? Is it your responsibility under your job description to go and look and see what has happened?
No. The statutes require that the assessor attend all Board of Review proceedings.
Right.
That's in section 70.48.
Right.
Section 70.47 sub 8 requires that the clerk be in attendance at all Board of Review proceedings. For purposes, to answer your question directly, it's generally the assessor that is representing the city in this matter.
Sure.
The assessor has to be made aware of the decisions of the Board of Review.
Right.
If the city, through its assessor or through any other agent, fails to inquire as to when that time period starts to run, the 90-day period begins to toll, mm-hmm. then that's no different than any other party that's subject to a statute of limitations. That's their risk if they don't ascertain that time.
You're using the city, which is a big entity that has many parts. What I'm having some concern with is what part of the city is supposed to be the person who receives notice. Is it the clerk? So once the clerk makes the affidavit, the city has notice?
Well, sure. A city is a municipal corporation. It's a legal entity that acts and is represented by its constituent members.
Okay, but who then proceeds to file for certiorari review? It's not the clerk. That's not what she does.
Well, that's right. I can use this case as an example. The assessor became aware of this action by the Board of Review. Mm-hmm. The assessor then brought it to my attention. The decision to seek legal action, in this case the filing of a petition for a writ of certiorari, belongs to the Common Council. The Common Council is the city's board of directors.
Okay.
In this case, the assessor recommended that there be a challenge to this. I presented this to the Common Council for their approval, explained the circumstances. The Common Council said, yes, file the petition for the writ of certiorari and challenge this.
So you get your authorization to sue from the Common Council.
That's right.
Without their okay, you wouldn't have brought a lawsuit.
That's correct. That's true in all cases.
So if it was a village, would the village board have to give the thumbs up in order to file a cert action?
Well, I'm not as familiar with village law as I am with city law, but if it's a parallel, then yes, the official actions of the municipal body have to be authorized in some fashion by the Common Council or the village board.
So this is why I'm asking, because on page 8 and 9 of the Board of Review's brief, they refer us to statute 70.46 sub 1, 70.471 sub 1, excuse me, sub 2M, sub 3, and sub 4. And they talk about the status of different boards of review of different municipal governments. And the point that they're making is that the tie between the municipal government and the Board of Review and the Board of Reviews are very, very close. And one of the examples that they give is that in a village, the default Board of Review is, in a town. In a town, the default Board of Review is the town board and the clerk. And then they go on and they say, they give other examples of towns, cities, and villages. The important point, according to the other side's brief, is
that by default, municipal boards of review are composed of members of the governing body, which is the body you're talking about that would give the thumbs up to Sue. And in many cases, the same people who serve as the board of review serve as the governing body of the taxation district. So you've been asked a lot of questions about how these two bodies, the boards of review and the governing body of a village or a town or a city, are merged together. So I think it's troubling to myself and to a number of my colleagues. Can you help me with that?
Yes, we're limited by what the statutes require us to do. The statutes set up that scheme, and that's the way these boards of review have to be appointed. There are many cities, Waukesha being one of them, that do not default back to the statutory composition of the board of review. And our board of review is made up entirely of citizens who are not members of the city government at all. So it's not a uniform case. That's just the default. The board of review, regardless of its composition, still remains a separate entity.
Well, so now are we going to apply this differently, depending on who's sitting on the board of review?
I'm sorry.
So you're saying that in Waukesha, it's a different group of people. There's a different group of people on the city council and a different group of people on the board of review.
Yes.
Right? And what I'm saying is, I understand that for Waukesha, but applying this to the rest of the state, that's not the case in other villages and towns, and perhaps not other cities.
Yes.
So what you're asking us to do in a situation where it is the same people is you are asking us to allow a review of someone's own decision.
Well, not the assessment is not the decision of the Common Council or the Village Board. It's a decision of another agent of the city or the village or the town, as the case may be. But it is still not the decision of the Common Council. So they are not judging their own decision. I think it's important that if the Board of Review is a separate entity, a quasi-judicial body before which the city is a party, it's nonsensical to think that somehow they are both the same entity. That doesn't make sense. They can't be a quasi-judicial body before which the city is a party if they are the same thing. I think that the members of the one body have their specific statutory duties. The members of the other body have their statutory duties. They are expected to follow those duties, to respect their oaths of office, to do what they're supposed to do. And I don't think that we should presume that somehow there's going to be an improper bias here.
In the scenario raised by Justice Karofsky, I'm just trying to think this through as a practical matter. Maybe the reason why you don't see a lot of these is when it's a combined effort and it is essentially the group of people that made the decision that you would have to seek relief from to appeal it, like in the town or the village, then that's not going to happen because they just got done making the decision, right? Whereas here in Waukesha, it's a separate group that you have to go to, the Common Council, to ask permission to appeal the Board of Review.
That's right. And that may very well be the case, that when they are composed of the same individuals, if they believe, if the assessor believes that the decision should be challenged, that it's very likely that they're going to say, no, we just made this decision. We believe it's correct, and we're not going to authorize an appeal. That may very well be the case. But I don't think that justifies us throwing out the baby with the bathwater and saying that precludes all appeals in cases where there may be justification. And as is the case with this matter, they are entirely separate. I don't think we should presume that there's going to be bias, that there's going to be some sort of insider dealing going on that results in an inequitable or unfair decision. And if there is, then there are means of appeal.
No, I see your time is fleeting away, and there's another part to this case, and that is whether the Board of Review erred when they made their decision and used the number that you're now appealing. My understanding is that they did not use the Markinian hierarchy, and they didn't follow what the statutes say they are to follow. The assessor didn't follow it. So the Board of Review didn't affirm the presumption that the assessor was correct, because he didn't use the process that the statutes say he has to use, and didn't consider things like there was either limited or no access readily available to this piece of property. What about the merits of your case?
Sure. The assessor testified several times that the valuation was made upon comparable sales data. The Board of Review argues, I believe improperly, in their brief. They repeat several times that the Board of Review jumped straight to Tier 3 data. It's simply not true. And the Board of Review, in its brief, cites and quotes the assessor several times where he's explaining that he used comparable sales data from other properties in the city. And that's how he arrived at the dollar amount per square foot. Never does he say that he used any other Tier 3 or other information. And not only that, but the Board of Review, in its brief, never does say what that other information was that the assessor allegedly used. They simply claim that the board of, or that the assessor jumped straight to Tier 3 without explaining what that was. However, by reading the Board of Review's brief alone, you can see the language quoted from the assessor in which he stated that he used comparable sales data in order to make that. He adjusted it according to the topography. He acknowledged that it would be difficult to develop because of the hills and so on. It's important to note that when the Board of Review made its decision, it did not make a finding that the taxpayer had overcome the presumption of correctness.
Yeah, but that's implied when they change the number. I mean, they can't get there otherwise, right? The presumption is a legal presumption.
I see my red light is on. May I continue?
It is. Please answer this question, and then you'll have to deal with us on rebuttal.
Thank you. Would you mind repeating the question,
please? I just said the board would not have changed the number on the assessor's assessment if they didn't overcome the presumption that it was correct. That's where they start out, is that the assessor is correct.
I disagree that that's the conclusion that can be drawn from the facts of this. They changed the number because they accepted the figure from the church. And the reason that they did, if you look carefully at their deliberations, you will listen to them say that they believed that everything was too speculative. But what they're saying is that the offer to purchase was too speculative. All of the questions that they asked about highway access, zoning, restrictive covenants, and so on and so forth, went to whether that $1 million offer to purchase would close or not. It did not go to questioning the basis on which the assessor made the assessment. They seized on that offer to purchase, even though the assessor explained that he used comparable sales data. The Board of Review believed that they could not make a decision until the offer to purchase closed, and that's not correct. If the assessor had been relying upon sales data for the subject property, then it would be correct. But the assessor relied upon sales data from comparable properties, and he made that quite clear in his testimony.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Larson? just waiting for the green light.
Thank you. May it please the court.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt right after may it please the court, but I have a fundamental question about the posture of the two issues before us. The city brought the single issue of whether the municipality can seek certiorari review of a decision of the Board of Review, and then you presented us with a second issue that goes to the merits, whether the Board of Review's ruling was in error or not. Do we need to reach the second issue if we affirm on the first issue?
You do not. It's my contention you do not need to address the second issue. I raised it in the event you rule in favor of the city on the first issue, then you would face the second issue.
So, in other words, it's an alternative basis for an affirmance if we rule against you on the first issue.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
I want this issue has been extensively briefed. I have very little to add to my brief, but I do want to comment on some of the issues that arose in the city's presentation. Boards of review have existed in this state for 153 years. This is the very first time today that this issue has reached a court of record. The city hypothecates that maybe these cases have happened before. Anecdotally, he thinks there might have been cases. I've practiced in this area for 30 years. In my firm, we have hundreds of years of experience in this area. All we do is municipal law. I've got 17 lawyers. That's all we do. I've handled hundreds of Board of Review cases. I've never heard of a municipality appealing the decision of its own Board of Review, the body in the municipality that is given the authority to make the final decision on tax assessments. I've never heard of it. This anecdote concerns me. The assertion that there might have been cases where some municipality has appealed its Board of Review, it should be very concerning to this court.
Counsel, what are you in relation to the city? Are you an agent? I thought I heard your opposing counsel say that. Maybe I didn't, but how would you describe your posture as it relates to the city?
My answer is that I'm a legal fiction. It's a legal fiction created by the city's attempt to create this appeal. It's not true. I am not separate from the city. My board is not separate from the city. We've had to play out this fiction for 3 years in order to present these arguments. But it's not true.
So, Mr. Larson, help me then understand in relation to that argument what I see and when I look at the statute, when I look at 70.47 sub 11, which talks about the parties and says, in all proceedings before the board, this is the important phrase, of course, right? I'm guessing you might be able to cite this by memory. The taxation district shall be a party in interest to secure or sustain an equitable assessment of all the property in the taxation district. So help me understand that statute as it relates to fees.
Well, if you'll allow me, I would like to step back so we can look at the history of this statute. And I think it helps to explain my answer to your question. When the Board of Review was initially created in 1868, the statute said the Board of Review is composed of the assessors, the clerk, and the mayor for a city. The assessors sat on the Board of Review. This idea that the Board of Review is somehow quasi-judicial, it is, but we need to focus on quasi. It's not a court. It's a review. It's an internal check. The last step, after the assessors have completed their work, they gather together and they review their work. That's what the Board of Review is. In those proceedings, it's essential that the taxation district have a voice. They need to be there to say why they've established those assessments that they did. That's why that statute says that the taxation district is a party. They should be there. They have to be heard. Why did you establish those assessments? The Board of Review is not just holding hearings. It is reviewing the entire role, making sure it's fair and equitable throughout the entire municipality. The League of Wisconsin Municipalities makes this point, and I agree with them in their amicus brief. That is the function of the Board of Review, not just to hear from those who object, but to look at every property throughout the city and ensure that it's fair and equitable, and the taxation district has to be there. Initially created, they were there on the board. And now they just have to be there. They're not sitting on the board. But it's the same function.
If the city ultimately were to prevail and the church's assessment would go up, presumably the city would then receive additional tax revenue from the church. Under the law, what would happen to that revenue? Would the taxpayers in the rest of the district get a refund because they initially were taxed at a higher rate because the church was taxed at a too low of a rate?
Frankly, I have no idea. I do not know. And what we're talking about when we calculate and do the math, it's about $5,600 in play in this case of tax revenue. What the city does with that revenue, I don't know. Do they mail out checks? It's about 10 cents per $100,000 of value. Are they going to send out checks? I don't know. Statute doesn't say. There is a statute that allows for the city to go back 2 years, but we're now going back 4 years. There is no statutory remedy. It would have to be a court-created remedy that somehow answers that question. What happens with this revenue? When does the church have to pay it? Don't know.
Council, you mentioned the amicus brief of the League of Municipalities. And they advance on page 1, the practical effect of the court's decision is to insulate all errors made by boards of review in favor of property owners, no matter how sizable, from court scrutiny, provided the property owner does not challenge the board's determination. How do you respond to that? We don't want to insulate from all errors. Can you respond to that assertion?
I certainly don't see it that way. The League of Wisconsin Municipalities sees the remedy provided by the state legislature as being a remedy that doesn't make sense. They say the taxpayer remedy provided in Wisconsin Statute Section 70.75 wouldn't make economic sense for the taxpayers to employ that remedy. Well, it's not for this court to say that the legislature erred in creating that remedy. That's the remedy that they created. They did. That's what they did. And frankly, it should be the taxpayers to decide. This case, to recover $5,000, is costing the taxpayers of the city of Waukesha many multiples of that, 10, 15 times at least, of my own time, not to mention the city's time. And so it should be the taxpayers that make that financial decision. Is it worth our effort to employ this remedy? And how will they know? The league also raises that. How will the taxpayers know? Well, if the city thinks that their board of review erred, why doesn't the city tell them? Frankly, that's the remedy that's provided. Maybe it doesn't work. I don't know. But it's the legislature that created it. It's not for this court to create a new remedy. For 153 years, they has never been a situation where that remedy has been needed. I don't think it's needed today. It's not closing a door. That door has never been open. That's my response. The city of Waukesha created a board of review that they intentionally, by their ordinance, by their law, was insulated from the political process. That's what they decided to do. They didn't have to, but that's what they did. They said they cannot be public officials. They have to be lay people. It doesn't mean that the political actors get to interfere later. They created that body. That body makes the final determination. If they don't like the determination, maybe they need to reconsider how they constituted it. But they insulated that border review from political influences, and the political players should not now get a kick at the cat and say, well, we didn't really mean to give you that authority. Now we're going to appeal you. Issue number one in this case is the issue of statutory interpretation. This court has had an ability to consider how statutes have been should be interpreted many times over the last year. Those cases have been contentious. They've been very difficult, and I sympathize with the court for having to face them, frankly. But I'm speaking of the COVID cases. I'm speaking of the Wisconsin legislature v. Palm, Fabick v. Evers, and most recently, James v. Heinrich. In James v. Heinrich, this court outlined a process for analyzing whether a statute grants power to a municipal official or not, and the extent of that power. And how do we analyze that? It was the divided opinion, but the opinion of the court, joined by the concurrence, begins with the language of the statute. The language of the statute here three times refers to the taxpayer. The one sentence that the city relies on refers only to the taxpayer and does so three times. It does not refer to the city, except as provided in 70.85. That's the first reference to the taxpayer. 70.85 is a statute that empowers the taxpayer to appeal to the Department of Revenue. Appeal from the determination of the Board of Review shall be an action for certiorari commenced within 90 days after the taxpayer. There's a second reference to the taxpayer. Receives notice under sub 12, a third reference to the taxpayer. That notice goes only to the taxpayer. And that notice, incidentally, is required by law to state the amount of the assessment and an explanation of appeal rights and procedures. It doesn't say only appeal rights of the taxpayer. It says an explanation of appeal rights. It's a state form. It's PR 302. It's required to be used. The Department of Revenue requires use of that form, and it explains all of the appeal rights. It does not explain that the city has any appeal rights. The state occupies the entire field. The Department of Revenue is specifically empowered to give guidance and to oversee the entire process. The state form describes the appeal rights. It does not describe any appeal right for the city. In James v. Heinrich, the dissent would stop there, but it would stop with just that one sentence. And I'm paraphrasing, and I'm sorry if I'm paraphrasing improperly, but the focus of the dissent was, let's look only at that one sentence. In that case, it was, local health officers may do what is reasonable and necessary for the prevention and suppression of disease. My argument today is that this case, the one sentence, is much less empowering to the municipality than in James v. Heinrich. In James v. Heinrich, there's no doubt that some power is given to the local health officer. It says that. Local health officers may do what is reasonable and necessary. Here, the sentence that the city relies on says nothing about empowering the municipal actors. Nothing. I think the dissent would agree here that if we stop with that one sentence, the city does not have a right of appeal. It doesn't say it. The court, joined with the concurrence, goes further. The court opinion says, it notes that the statute, what the statute does not say. In James V. Heinrich, the statute did not say that the health officer has the power to close schools. It didn't say that.
Counsel, don't we always look at context, right? I don't know that... I disagree with your characterization of the dissent. But I don't think that...
Having written it.
I don't think that necessarily that you need to be arguing what you're arguing. Do you have context on your side as well? I mean, aren't we to look... We don't look at statutes alone. We look at them in the context of which they're written. And do you have context on your side here, too, when you're looking at the entirety of that statute other than that one little phrase?
Absolutely. The context, first of all, is one we've already mentioned in 70.47 sub 11. The board, the taxation district, is given power before the board. It uses the phrase before the board. There is no comparable language for an appeal. If they had intended to empower the city to appeal, they could have done that. They gave the city the power to be there before the board. So that point of context is essential. I would also point to the legislative history. We have very clear legislative history in this case. I've already mentioned that when it was initially created, it's very clear that it's supposed to be just a review. This is a review body. Let's review our role. Let's review our work. It's called a board of review. But if we look at the phrase that is critical to this case, the phrase that says, commenced within 90 days after the taxpayer receives the notice under sub 12, that was added to the statute by 1993 Wisconsin Act 307. When it was added, we have two important bits of legislative history that describe this statute and the intent of that phrase. The Legislative Reference Bureau said, under current law, and it's not even talking about the amendment, saying under current law, persons may appeal property tax assessments to a board of review. Persons may appeal property tax assessments to a board of review, and they, referring back to the persons, may appeal a board of review's decision to the circuit court. The deadline for the latter appeal is 90 days after the board of review adjourns. Under this bill, that deadline is 90 days after the person, referring back again to the person who appeals their property tax assessment, receives a notice of the board of review's decision. It could hardly be more clear. The Legislative Reference Bureau answers the question we're faced in this case. They say that the taxpayer has a right of appeal. The Department of Revenue analysis of this bill that was circulated when it was adopted answers it even more clearly. And remember that the Department of Revenue has the obligation to oversee the entire tax scheme. It's their obligation to do it. They provide the guidance. And they tell the state legislature what this means this way. The changes clarify the intended meaning of the 90-day period during which a property owner may appeal a board of review's decision to circuit court. 70.47 sub 13 is a right of the taxpayer
Counsel,
to appeal.
With regard to your argument that... That emphasizes persons, however, under Chapter 990, a person would be include a legal political entity, wouldn't it? I'm reading from, this is not meant to be a test. 990.01 sub 26. Person. Persons includes all partnership associations and bodies politic or corporate. So if that's the definition of person, how does that play into your emphasizing that it's a person?
Well, neither of these statements of legislative history would rely on that definition. First of all, the Legislative Reference Bureau says appeal property taxes. Appeal property tax assessments. Persons may do so. That can only be the owner of the property. It can't be the municipality appealing property tax assessment to the Board of Review. In the Department of Revenue statement, they don't use the word person. It says clarify the meaning of the 90-day period during which a property owner may appeal a Board of Review's decision to Circuit Court. So I don't think that 990 definition of person is going to play into this analysis with all due.
Okay, it may not. I just heard you emphasize it, and I recalled that the definition of person in the law was broader than what I heard
sure.
you arguing.
Thank you.
Mr. Larson, could you talk to us about the second issue in this case and tell us what your best argument is as to the cert review?
There is no possible way that what the assessor did in this case can be viewed as Tier 2 evidence. That would be outrageous. The assessor provided not a single property by address, not a single property by sale date, not a single property by the amount of the sale, no description of the attributes of the property, no indication of whether adjustments have been made. We have a very clear record, more clear than we often get. We have a videotape of what happened in that hearing. I encourage the court to review it. There is no way to conclude that Tier 2 evidence was presented in this case that would be extremely damaging to the practice of assessment and the practice of the Board of Review to conclude that that was Tier 2 evidence. It was not. If you read the Markarian case, the facts of Markarian are virtually identical. It's eerie how identical they are to the facts of this case. You've got a corner lot. You've got a lot that the assessor is valuing bits and pieces of it when, in fact, it's only one undivided parcel. You've got no evidence of any sales of property, how much they sold for. In addition to the Markarian case, I've cited other cases that explain what the Tier 2 method entails. It entails you have to identify the property. More concerning to me, even than the fact that the assessor didn't present that evidence, the assessor clearly did not do it. Clearly, the assessor did not look to sales of property when assessing this property. There's no indication that he did. I disagree with the statement of the city. I'm sorry.
So what I'm hearing you say is you are attacking the assessor's actions. And what Mr. Running says in response to that is that what we're supposed to be looking at here is the Board of Review's actions and not the assessor's actions. And by making that particular argument, you're flipping the burden of proof by attacking the assessor's valuation rather than showing how the church overcame the presumption of correctness. Can you address that, please?
Our role in a certiorari action is to review the Board of Review's action. That's what we do on a cert appeal. It's to determine whether they acted in accordance with law, kept within their jurisdiction, and so forth. And they are presumed correct. The presumption that we look to now is a presumption that the Board of Review acted in accordance with law. That's the applicable presumption now. The Board of Review was not represented, by the way. I think it's important to recognize that the city attorney was not there, even though the Department of Revenue's guidance says that the municipal attorney should be present to help the Board of Review in its deliberations. It didn't happen. And so they may not have been using terms that we would wish they would have used.
Before your time runs out, I want to ask you this question because I want to make sure I understand what you are saying. What I'm hearing you say is that we are not to concern ourselves in this cert action with the presumption of correctness as it applies to the assessor. What I'm hearing you say is don't worry about that. What you need to be concerned about is the presumption that the Board of Review now enjoys. Am I understanding you correctly?
Correct. I mean, our role is to determine, did they act lawfully? That obviously requires you to look at the presumption and so forth. I don't dispute that the assessor at that hearing was presumed correct. But if he did not act in accordance with law, that presumption goes away. And so viewing the decision of the Board of Review, as we do on cert, and granting deference to the Board of Review, we look to what was presented in that hearing and could the Board of Review have reached the decision that it did. And absolutely they could have. The reason is that the assessor did not follow the law in establishing this assessment. I haven't mentioned the other argument in my brief that uniformity is definitely an issue in this case. I'm not abandoning that argument. I think I'm going to run out of time, but just quickly.
I'm going to have you move on, though, if you don't mind.
Thank you.
I'm right here.
Yes.
Sorry, because you are running out of time. Is it true that the only, I mean, the Board of Review is dealing with two different numbers, essentially, right, that are presented to us. Is it true that they could only adopt one or the other? That seems to be the argument. Or couldn't they have taken something in between? Is it there? What are they tasked with at that point? I know there's a presumption, and then if it's overcome, but is there a way that they reach a different resolution?
When the Department of Revenue trains members of the Board of Review, they encourage the members to ensure that they have evidence to support what they're doing. And if you have an argument for one value and an argument for the other value, that's your best likelihood of having evidence. And they're not assessors. They don't get to reassess the property. And so
they don't get to plug in and say 50%, it wasn't appropriate for this piece or that piece. They're not encouraged to do that, is what you're saying.
They are not encouraged to do that. And I would be very concerned if they would, because there has to be an extremely clear record for them to choose a number. When I'm guiding my boards of review, my general advice, unless it's very unusual circumstances, is you should be looking at the number proposed by the assessor and the number proposed by the taxpayer, and that's it.
Thank you.
Counsel, the idea that there are two parties, according to statute, parties of interest, at a quasi-judicial proceeding, and that there only one of them can appeal the determination is a bit of an anathema. I don't know of any other statutory construct that would provide for two parties, but only one can appeal. Is there any that you can point to that would be similarly situated, where the legislature is limiting who can appeal? That a party can appeal?
I'm sorry, I have not looked for that. I think we might find it if we did look. But I don't have an answer to that one. I think when you look at the role and the function of the Board of Review, though, it does make sense. The Board of Review is empowered to be the final arbiter. They are the final arbiter for the taxation jurisdiction. They are part of the taxation jurisdiction. In every case that has been reported in Wisconsin for 153 years involving the Board of Review, the Board of Review has not existed. The Board of Review is a named party, but they're gone. When it's on appeal, the taxation district is represented by the Common Council. That's always true. They pay for it. They hire counsel. They direct the appeal. And my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
The first issue regarding whether the city has authorization to seek certiorari appeal, certiorari review of the Board of Review, is a pure statutory construction question. All of the parties here agree that the statutory language in question is unambiguous. Nobody has claimed that. Everybody agrees that it's unambiguous. The rules of construction are extremely clear that when you have an unambiguous statute, it must be applied according to its plain language. Context is important, but only to the extent that the context can be found within that statute itself. We've heard a lot of extrinsic evidence here, from legislative history down to the fact that there are no reported cases. That in itself is a piece of extrinsic evidence. It has no bearing on what the language of the statute means. We have to apply the statute according to its plain meaning if it is not ambiguous. There's no way to read subsection 13 as allowing appeal only to one party without reading into it words that aren't there. And we can't do that. Secondarily, about the presumption, the implication here that the presumption of correctness only applies if the assessor has done the assessment correctly is not true. The cases make it very clear that the presumption exists as soon as the assessor presents the assessment in question.
Counsel, I just want to go back to your first point briefly again. In your argument before, and I didn't get a chance to ask you, but I thought I heard you say that the Board of Review was an agent. And I may have misheard you, but if that's correct, I wouldn't mind if you confirm that. Your opposing counsel says that he, in fact, does not exist, which is fantastic. But he's a legal fiction. His client's a legal fiction. I wonder if you'd respond to those questions.
Yeah, I don't believe I said that the Board of Review is an agent.
Okay.
If I did, I misspoke.
Okay.
Because that would mean that it is not a quasi-judicial body before which the city can appear. The Board of Review is, it's a legal fiction, just as a corporation or an LLC or a municipal corporation is a fiction. It's an entity that is composed of it exists on its own, but it's directed by its constituent members. So, yes, the Board of Review is a fictional entity in that sense. But that does not mean that it doesn't exist. It exists as a corporate body politic before which the city appears as a party. The context that we see when we look only at 7047 the way we should shows that overall the scheme is to ensure equitable assessments. And in subsection 13, it says that a court upon certiorari review shall correct any errors, not just errors that favor the city.
So one follow-up question. Sorry, counsel. One follow-up question. At what point is a decision adverse to the city when the Board of Review makes a decision? So is it at what point does it is it something that you would have a right to appeal a petition first?
Be adverse if the Board of Review reduces the assessment. And, of course, then it becomes a question of degree as to whether or not the city wants to appeal that. Some of those differences will be meaningless. Some of them will be pretty egregious. And that's how the Waukesha Common Council viewed this one. An 83% reduction crossed their line for saying, yes, we need to challenge this. But any reduction in the assessment is, by definition, an adverse result.
Where does it say that, though? I mean, I listening to Justice Hagedorn's question, he raises a good point. So you're saying that some, I mean, where does it say that that's, normally an adverse decision is understood at what it is. You're saying even a penny less is an adverse decision?
Well, theoretically, sure. But as I say, it's a matter of degree whether or not it becomes actionable.
Why is it adverse to the city, though? Because it as I understand the tax scheme, I hope I'll use the right expressions, but the tax levy is what it is. So if the church is underassessed, it means the other taxpayers in the district are going to have a higher tax bill. And I guess that goes back to my question I posed to your friend on the other side. Where does the money go if the city ultimately prevails and the church's assessment is increased? Will the taxpayers receive a refund because they paid too high of a tax rate? Is there a law that addresses where the money goes?
Time
go ahead and answer
expired.
The question.
Thank you. I do not know. I presume that the taxpayers would not receive a refund. It would be ridiculous to think that a tiny check of less than a dollar is going to be mailed out in the city. Certainly, there are statutory procedures that the assessor and the treasurer follow when they handle income. And certainly, there are instances where money is received, tax revenue, after that tax year closes. There are procedures for that. I cannot direct you to the specific statutes that control that.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for interesting briefs and oral argument. The court will reconvene at 1:30 in conference. And in the meantime, Justice Hagedorn will be coming out shortly to discuss your very pressing question.
Justice is assigned two law clerks, and so the law clerks read all the briefs, and they
cheers. he's going to grab some more chairs, and if you want to help him, by all means.
Hi there.
One more.